Yeah. What's going on, world? My name is FNX, and you are now tuning into the Universal Frequency. Energy frequency vibration. Energy frequency vibration. Welcome back. Happy Friday. Of course, shout out to Donkey Bongs TV. That's who we are powered by. Shout out to Mind's Eye Productions for producing the intro and this wonderful instrumental today. man, today we got a good show, man. We're going to talk about housing and how it correlates to poverty. It doesn't correlate to poverty. And I think this is a really important topic because you may have heard me say it before. I was a displaced youth. I know other displaced youths, and I understand some of the challenges that a child that may be dealing with abuse in the home, or he may not have a secure place to stay, or who may be hungry, or any of these things have to go into school and perform with their peers. And sometimes they're distracted. And how some of the things I've just mentioned to you are correlated with whether they live in a home or they rent a home. Or excuse me, whether their parents own a home or whether they rent a home. So we're gonna bust it down. It's deep. I got some dope resources for you. And I'm excited, man. Happy Friday. Happy Father's Day coming up. Happy Juneteenth to all my people out there. Hope we don't have any more non-believers. So we're going to get into it. All right. So I have an article here that I want to share with you guys. This is 7 things you should know about poverty and housing. This is by Habitat for Humanity. Definitely a dope organization. They build homes, they help people, they raise awareness for housing. And if you have not been to habitat.org, please go visit. But 7 things you should know about poverty and housing. Okay. And we've talked about some of this before, so this is somewhat vindicating, but not really, right? Because it's terrible. But there are different definitions of poverty. Right, so there's no international consensus on measuring poverty. Generally, absolute poverty thresholds are determined by measuring survival needs like food and shelter for different sized households. You know, I've heard that before. I've heard that, especially from some of my brethren who are from the islands or from a different country, that poor in America is not poor in a third world country. I've heard that, you may have heard that. But the struggle is a struggle. You know, and I do my best not to compare pain. You know, I also know that despite me being displaced as a youth, staying in a shelter whatever it is that you deal with in the poverty cycle, right? All of those things are not like, you know, missing running water or having, right? Or shelter. You know, like staying in the shelter was terrible, but there's some people who legitimately sleep outside all the time, right? These are things that there's levels to. So there's definitely different definitions of poverty. There could be things like access to clean water, sanitation, electricity, quality of housing. These all play a role into whether a family can live a decent life. Okay. Second thing, people living in poor circumstances are not necessarily who or where you think. And so I can testify to this, right? I can testify to this because when the first year we actually did the Hometown Love Holiday Food Drive, we connected with social services in a specific city, and we got the address of a family that actually lived in a very affluent area. So the first thing I said was, oh, for real? You know, my ignorance, right? But I also know that God's guiding any resources that we raise to the right place. So we end up in a very, very affluent area, go up to this big house, and we bring in, like, I don't know, bro, like 20 bags of food. Fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, 2 whole chickens, a ham, and maybe even a turkey. And the lady just starts bawling. And people think because we live in this big house that we have it so easy. My husband's dealing with health issues. We're behind on the mortgage. You don't know how hard it is. We really needed this, et cetera, et cetera. And I can empathize with that, right? For real. I can legitimately empathize with that sort of pain. So the size of your house don't matter whether you live in a poor circumstances. I mean, I also think health is extremely, health is wealth, right? So if you're dealing with poverty financially and you're dealing with health challenges, that's an uphill battle. That's an uphill battle. So this article says the family can fall into poverty for many reasons. Medical emergencies, crop failures, sudden unemployment. In the U.S., 2 out of 5 households don't have the savings to get through a financial shock, while 1 of every 5 children struggles with a lack of adequate resources. I believe that. I absolutely believe that, because 1 out of 6 children in the state of Connecticut are food insecure. Right? That's a fact. That's actually higher than the national average. And we also know that in affluent areas, that number's probably lower. And in low to moderate income communities, that number's probably high. So this is a real thing. All right. Number 3. Right now, remember, this is part of the Habitat for Humanity's article, 7 things you should know about poverty and housing. I thought this was interesting. Affordable housing can be hard to find. In many regions of the world, the number of low income households far exceeds the affordable housing units available. In the US, for every 100 renter households classified as extremely low income, just 35 rental units are both available and affordable. Wow. Globally, the housing affordability gap, meaning the difference between income available for housing and the market price of a standard housing unit in the region, amounts to nearly $650 billion per year. That's crazy. In the U.S., for every 100 renter households classified as extremely low income, just 35 rental units are both available and affordable. That means 75% of renter households classified as extremely low income cannot find affordable or available housing. Right, so the question that I ask is, where do people sleep? How do their kids do their homework? And I know we haven't gotten to the home ownership part of this yet, but this is staggering, to be honest with you. I was not aware when I read this article. I was taken back, right? I mean, I knew it was a large number, but 75% seems excessively high. And you just wonder, are these people sleeping with family, is it shelter, or are people sleeping outside? Do they have a place to sleep at all? You know, that's real. Number 4, a full-time job or 2 might not be enough for a family to afford a decent place to live. Wow. Nowhere in the U.S. can a worker... Hold on, let me get the music back up. We're still rocking. Nowhere in the U.S. can a worker earning the federal or prevailing state minimum wage rent a 2-bedroom apartment without having to pay more than 30% of their income. In fact, a minimum wage worker must clock nearly 127 hours per week, more than 3 full-time jobs, to afford a 2-bedroom rental, or 103 hours per week, more than 2.5 full-time jobs, to afford a 1-bedroom. And this is crazy because it wasn't always like this, right? Your grandparents didn't deal with an economy to where they had to work 3 full-time jobs to pay the rent. A lot of these households came from one person at home and one person working. I mean, things were a lot different back then, but this is staggering. It's one of the reasons that people call for a guaranteed minimum wage. You know, and the capitalists in the building or in the room may disagree, because there's numbers that show that's bad for business, but I mean, I don't have the answers. I don't have the answers. But it should not be a way where people have to work 127 hours a week just to provide rent. What if they have children? How do they help their children with their homework? How do they prepare their children for success if they're working multiple jobs to barely get by? That seems like a cycle. That seems like a cycle. And it gets deep when we start talking about redlining and maybe putting the wagon before the horse. But redlining was the practice of banks and mortgage companies of deliberately impacting who was able to purchase homes. Actually, we're gonna get into redlining in a second. I'm gonna give you the game on that. But having a house or apartment doesn't mean you weren't living in poor circumstances. Again, we just talked about that. Now, I happen to think that having a house that you own and still struggling does have, I want to say, a bit more pros than having the same scenario in a rental property. But if you're unable to pay the mortgage or the rent, both in terrible situations. One of the great things about owning a home is that the money that you pay monthly goes towards equity. Eventually, as you pay down your mortgage loan, then eventually you'll be able to tap into the equity by borrowing it, cashing it out, or whenever you sell the home, you can pocket. That's a huge asset and a wealth distribution tool. So when you're renting or paying your landlord's mortgage, you aren't getting that benefit. So that's where I'm coming from. But this means not having the resources to get by in general. And people still struggling. This is crazy. It's crazy. According to Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies, nearly 38 million American households, so 31.5%, are paying more than 30% incomes on housing, forcing them to maintain a nearly impossible balance and making hard decisions about food, transportation, and health. Meanwhile, 1 in 6 households are paying more than half of their income on housing and are considered severely cost burden. I mean, COVID showed us that, yo. Now, this one is deep. Insecure tenure or the threat of eviction is reality for many living across the world, depriving people of even the most physical, economic, and psychological security of adequate shelter. Yo, that is so real. That is so real, yo. That is so real. The psychological security of adequate shelter. Like, this shit triggers me. Right? Not knowing where you're gonna sleep, not knowing where you're gonna stay, if it's gonna be safe, if it's gonna be drama-free, let alone warm and dry and shit like that. Like, I mean, children shouldn't have to worry about that. That's my belief. And we, in the world that we live in, we know that's not, or it's impossible just yet, but these are things that are really powerful dynamics to overcome. You know, insecure tenure. Yo, this is bringing me back. This is bringing me back, you know, to being like, yo, my world, we gonna stay. And we don't know. And it's like, why would you give a fuck about homework? Right? And if you don't know where you gonna sleep at. So this shit is real, yo. This shit is real. That'll distract you. That's crazy. This took me off course, man. One time I was working, and I think those of you may know that I used to work in a bank, right? So I was in the lobby, and I heard a young person next to mom, "Where are we gonna stay tonight?" My mom was like, "I don't know." And it just sent chills down the spine, right? Because it brought me back. Like, this shit is chilling, man. Wow. Poverty perpetuates, but so does home ownership. A safe, decent, affordable place to live can make a real difference in the life of a family. Home ownership has long been the primary way for families to build wealth. I just told you that. Home ownership also offers stability because monthly mortgage payments are predictable, whereas rents can increase year over year. There are some places in the United States now that it's more expensive to rent than to buy, which also adds to the poverty cycle. Children who change schools as their families move in search of more affordable housing can struggle to keep up academically. Bingo, yo. Bingo. And this says a lot, man, because I was a child that went through this. Me and my sister were children that moved around. My siblings moved around, right? And the fact that my mother still was able to make sure we performed academically. I mean, honor students across the board. It's powerful. But it shouldn't have to be this hard. You know what I mean? Let me stop sharing for a second. Yo, it shouldn't have to be this hard. The articles that I'm talking about, I mean, children who change schools as their families move in search of affordable housing and struggle to keep up academically, that's real life. Where are we doing the homework at? Why do you give a fuck about the homework? Right? And then these kids go to school and judgments are made about them at a very young age. Some say those statistics were even used to build prisons, right? I'm not going to get into that conversation now. But there's a connection being made here. And there's a bunch of different economic pieces in place to make sure a cycle is perpetuated, yo. And this is heavy. This is heavy. This is heavy. So I promised I was going to talk to you about redlining, right? And this story is actually kind of dope, right? Because I didn't know what redlining was up until, I don't know, my mid-20s. I was in training for a job, and they had an economics piece. And I was in New York, and this trainer was this white dude with freckles, right? From Kansas. You would think he was completely disconnected. And he started dropping gems on redlining. And then he was like, what? You think because I'm a white dude from Kansas, since I got freckles and red hair, I don't know what it is? He's like, and he goes, if I know what it is, you should absolutely know what it is. And that kind of hit me. That's real shit, man. Real shit. So here, so let's talk about redlining. Let's go. Make sure you smash that like button, man. Whoever tuning in, like, comment. Some of y'all gonna get this later, which is fine. As long as you get it. Okay. Now this is from the Primary Care Development Corporation, right? And I think this has a good narrative to explain what the redlining is. So in 1938, the Homeowners Loan Corporation created a so-called residential security maps to guide entities towards practicing responsible lending. Neighborhoods deemed hazardous from lending were outlined in red, a process we know today as redlining. These maps were used as the basis to systematically deny mortgages and services to residents of redlined neighborhoods, regardless of individual credit worthiness. Predominantly black and urban neighborhoods were redlined, and this is about New York. Despite being banned in the Fair Housing Act of 1958, decades of disinvestment have contributed to long-lasting effects of residents of formerly redlined communities. That's real. Let me say this again. You know, these maps were used as the basis to systematically deny mortgages and services to residents of redlined neighborhoods, regardless of individual credit worthiness. So when they talk about these ghettos, these projects, these tenements, and the systematic issues that come from these places, and how we're demonized for either perpetuating or dealing with these issues, the whole time there was economic practices in place to steer people of color and keep them there. Right? And keep them there. That said, regardless of credit worthiness. So there were people of color that had the financial ability to buy homes in different areas, but they were systematically denied, right? Which keeps us renting, which keeps us dealing with certain issues, which keeps our children dealing with certain issues and unfocused, which leads to academic performance. Now, I'm saying this loosely, but I hope you understand how each one of these steps are pieces to a larger puzzle. Being real. Smash the like button, man. It's real. So I also wanted to show you this article about how housing affects children's outcomes. So follow me what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about how we are systematically denied from purchasing homes and accumulating homes, which is not only a big wealth accumulating practice, one of the largest assets you can purchase, but it also has socioeconomic impact. Because it keeps kids in a poverty cycle, keeps families in a poverty cycle, and as a result, children are ill-prepared, they move a lot, they deal with systematic issues or maybe crime that are in these areas. And then they have to go to school and judgments are made on them. And then the first chance they get, they want to throw cuffs on them. It's real, man. Formerly redlined areas have a poverty rate of 3.6 times that of A-rated census tracts, right? Makes sense. Redlined areas probably have a lot of poor people because that's what it was designed to do. The proportion of black residents in redlined areas is 9.1 times higher than that of A-rated census tracts. You know that already. I would say black and Spanish and minorities, depending on which part of the country that you're at. But definitely the poor melanated people, for real. 17.8% of adults in formerly redlined areas are uninsured, compared to 6.4% in A-rated census tracts. That's crazy. So, adults are uninsured at three times a higher rate if they came from a formerly redlined area. Now, you may have heard me say this before, but life insurance is the basis for any financial plan. Any financial advisor will tell you that. They will tell you that before you go in and start setting up a portfolio, stocks, bonds, options, whatever, that you need to have life insurance in place to protect that foundation should something happen to you. So this is a financial literacy like building block. And we now know that adults are three times more likely to be uninsured if they come from a redlined area. That's a huge disparity. It also says that 26.6% of adults in formerly redlined areas are obese, compared to 16.2% in A-rated census tracts, which is interesting. Wow, there's a lot that says to that. Maybe that has to do with the quality of food, quality of life. We all know that stress makes people, stress can make people take out their anxiety in food and eating. And if you don't have access to healthy food options, that's an issue. A lot of places are food deserts. Y'all ever heard of food desert? Shit is tripping. When I heard this, this blew my mind. So a food desert is an area that has limited access to affordable and nutritious food, right? So the city of Bridgeport is a food desert, bro. Bridgeport, Connecticut. There are parts of Bridgeport that food deserts exist. That's bananas, bro. When you consider the amount of people that live here, how large the city is, there are places that people could not find affordable, healthy foods. That's nuts to me, man. The U.S. Department of Agriculture calls Hartford a food desert when it comes to the limited accessibility of healthy foods. Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford are categorized as food deserts. I wonder what they have in common. For those of y'all not familiar with Connecticut. And you may not be, right? But one thing that I'll tell you from my travels is that Connecticut is like any other state in this country, or even like any other place in this world where there's have and there's have nots. And between that line, crime exists and there's systematic issues. And I've traveled enough to see that there's dope fiends here, there's dope fiends in Seattle, there's dope fiends in Portland, you know what I'm saying? There's dope fiends in Phoenix, Arizona. There's dope fiends in Alberta, Canada. Like, these are symptoms of the disease of poverty. Important. All right. So let's get to the other article I wanted to show you. Share screen. So this is the Urban Institute Initiative, right? This is an article from January 2019, how housing affects children's outcomes. So this very first line, housing inequality, instability, and unaffordability threaten the well-being of millions of children across the nation. Millions of children across the nation. Research shows that housing is the first rung of the ladder to economic opportunity, that a person's access to opportunity is intrinsically linked with that of the community of where they live. Let's say that again. Research shows that housing is the first rung of the ladder to economic opportunity, that a person's access to opportunity is intrinsically linked with that of the community where they live. This is one of the reasons why owning a home, if you can, is a better scenario than renting a home for your children, statistically. And I apologize if I'm saying this like it's easy for everyone to purchase a home, because it's not. But I do believe there is a pathway through. I've seen people come to this country. I've seen immigrants. I've seen people come home from jail. I've seen people that have just gotten started late that have gotten themselves mortgage ready and got into the game of acquiring assets that appreciate and can build equity. All right. As home prices increase, the gap between rents and incomes continues to widen. Nearly half of today's renters are cost burdened. Child welfare professionals, educators, and pediatricians can strengthen the work by understanding the central importance of housing as a determinant of wide-ranging outcomes for the child's youngest generation. Like, yo, real shit. I feel like they talking about me. And I hate to make this about me, right? But like, as I'm reading this, and people that I know who are going through similar scenarios, where they either moved around a lot in searching for stability and affordable housing, like, that shit is traumatizing. I even be real with you. Naturally, I'm an introvert. So us moving around a lot made me have to like establish like new friends and shit like that constantly. Those are sort of things that form a personality about a person. And it's probably one of my biggest blessings, because I could talk to anybody. But going through it, the anxiety that I had because I did not have stability probably also caused me to act in certain manners. Poor housing quality is associated with higher baseline symptoms of depression, anxiety, and aggression from elementary through young adulthood. Absolutely correct. Anyone that's ever lived in the projects will tell you that. Any hood, anything like that, any big ass building where people live on top of each other will tell you that. This is crazy, yo. A study of 75 homeless families receiving child welfare services found that child and family safety were perceived as less important than availability and affordability when caregivers were making housing decisions. Child and family safety were perceived less important than availability and affordability. This points to a need for housing reform, child welfare services to ensure homeless families' long-term safety. So this study is saying, this study is saying that, yo, this is nuts. This is nuts. Found that child and family safety perceived as less important than availability and affordability, as this safety is something that can be negotiated. And this shit is real, and this shit is real, because my mother used to say this all the time, just because we're poor don't mean we have to accept that. When I spoke to you guys about the homeless song that I did, we're gonna get to that video, right? I figure it's episode one. If not, I'll talk about it again. But either way, man, homeless is a story where I talk about us getting evicted. Because, you know, during my sophomore year of high school, after my mother got divorced, she got her separate apartment by herself without my stepfather. We had to let that house go. Came home one day, all that shit was in the lawn. Ended up going to a shelter. Stayed in the shelter for a couple days. Pastor tried to fuck my mom. Mom was like, we're not with it. We out, right? And I thought that, not just my mom, other abused women, which is terrible, by the way. And that entire time, I thought it was because we had just gotten evicted. When really, my mother had just found out towards the time before us to go that our next door neighbor was a predator. And that because we were poor doesn't mean we're going to accept her knowingly living next to a predator because it was not safe. And I even remember people arguing with her. Like, oh, why don't you just live here? Why don't you just live there? And my mother would be like, no, it's not safe for my children. Just because it's a place to stay doesn't mean it's a place that we should stay. And she was fighting this battle that I'm talking about. Crazy. Honestly, until I got to this point, I didn't realize how strong she is. Okay. So, we've talked about the impact that housing can have on a child's development. And we talked about the impact of poverty and how that's correlated with renting versus owning, right? And here's what I have to say. And we're going to talk, but we're going to have full episodes of Mortgage 101 on how to get yourself mortgage ready and get yourself in the game and establish a plan just so you can make this happen for yourself, right? So I'm not speaking from a space of ignorance, but I am speaking from a space of we have to get motivated, we have to seek resources, and we have to understand how important this is to our future generations. And I say that for the people that aren't trying. For those of you that are trying, that are actively looking to purchase homes, and even though the housing market is crazy now, don't let that deter you because everything is cyclical. So while the inventory is low, right, and the housing rates are crazy, continue to get your credit and your assets together, right? So there's three parts of a loan: credit, income, and assets, right? So there are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines around credit. Conventional mortgages have a 620 FICO floor. FHA loans have 580. Now, please go do your own research as I talk about this. I just want to explain this dynamic. A lot of us have been taught that credit is bad and credit is negative. That if you have the cash for something, you should just pay the cash. When the reality is, there are people that are very, very affluent that have, I'm talking about millionaires, rich people, right? That will put every purchase they make on a credit card, pay off the credit card monthly, while building their credit and getting rewards or points, which is sometimes more money if you're getting cash back than you may make in a savings account, which may be rewards for miles. So if they're traveling and they fly a lot, they're using their credit card rewards to pay for their flying miles, right? All while building good credit history. So you have to embrace leveraging a credit card. And for those of you that have got yourself in the hole, and I'm speaking very broadly here, right? But the same way I cannot make a health assessment about you just looking over the internet about your weight. I wouldn't be able to do it about your credit. But what I can tell you is the best thing you can do is look at your credit report, fix any delinquencies, any outstanding monies paid, get all derogatory information off there if possible. That's huge. Okay? That can include by you reaching out to the creditors, making arrangements. That can include with you maybe disputing a couple things directly with the credit bureaus. But make sure you address every line item. And then you're going to have to figure out a way to get a credit line. So, more often than not, if you are doing some sort of credit repair, you're not going to be able to just walk into a local bank and get an unsecured credit card. You may have to go get a secured credit card where you put up a portion of your own funds in order for you to, for that bank to lend to you. They use that as collateral. You establish your credit history that way, right? Using the card, paying it off. Using the card, paying it off. You do that over time. That'll show lenders that you have a trade line. That'll show the credit bureaus that you have a trade line that you're using appropriately. And as you build your rapport, other people, companies will want to lend to you. This is a systematic process. This process may not happen over 6 months, but I have seen it happen over years. So if you have credits in the 470s, right? You get your credit report, you address each item line by line, you're rid of the things that aren't supposed to be there, make your payment arrangements, pay off all your debt, get some cash together, go get yourself a secure card. As long as you haven't blatantly committed fraud, you'll be able to get a secure credit card. And then you use that to systematically drive your credit, right? Other good credit behaviors, or obviously making all your payments on time. It's also recommended to maintain a 33.3% 30% credit utilization, right? If you have a card that has a $100 limit, carrying around a 30% balance, typically, from what we know, may give you your optimal score. I would also tell you if you can pay it off, just pay it off. Like they say, around 33% is good utilization. Which makes sense because you want to show lenders that if they give you a loan, that you are going to use it. If you don't use it, they don't make money. So at some point, we have to let them know that you can be profitable. So boom, that's your credit, right? By the way, the better your credit is, the better rates you will get. So the 620 conventional floor, the 580 FHA floor, those are the bare minimums that you need credit-wise to qualify for those loans. But I would say you want to shoot for a 740 plus score. That's when you get your best pricing. And it can happen. It may not happen overnight, but it absolutely can happen. All right? So, credit. We're going to talk about that a million times. Credit. Don't be afraid of it. It can be your friend. And you can use it to open doors for it. And income. Okay? So, the loans that you're going to apply for, they're going to look at how much you make versus how much you spend on a monthly basis, right? And depending on whether the loan you're looking for is going to be underwritten by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines, and I can talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac later, there are guidelines to eligibility. Sometimes banks have their own guidelines based on deposits or a particular program that they have. But on a monthly basis, your fixed payments, including your housing ratio, typically just you don't want it above 45%. Some lenders can go as high as 50. Excuse me, not lenders. Some products can go up to 50% debt to income. But we're talking about your car note, your student loans, any installment loans you may have. The minimum payments for all your credit cards or any variable debt. In addition to your housing payment, it cannot exceed 45% of your income. So one thing that I did when I was looking for a home was I took my annual salary, I divided it by 12. I knew what I had monthly. I took away all my fixed expenses. I multiplied that times 45%, took that number, 45% of my monthly income, I minus all my fixed expenses, and whatever was left over, I knew was my housing budget. So when I was looking at mortgage payments, interest, taxes, principal, all that combined, I would know, hey, this is either above or below what I can afford. That's how you look at the math. Now, your loan officer, when you go to a mortgage company, can do that for you. But I always wanted to know where I stood so I can know if there's a miscalculation, right? And I'll say it again. You take your monthly income, how much your salary, right? Take your annual salary divided by 12, that's your monthly amount. 45% of that is what is recommended for a debt-to-income ratio. So the amount of your fixed expenses should not exceed 45%. So car note, student loans, minimum payments of credit cards, anything fixed, does not include utilities. You take that minus that 45% amount, that'll let you know potentially what your budget is for. All right. Now, for those of you that work on commission, you're probably going to have to take a look at 2 years' tax returns if you've been making commission for 2 years, being honest, or look at the last 2 years' end of year pay stubs to understand what your history is with making commission or bonus. And then some other things can get weird, like if you're a flight attendant or you're a truck driver, you get paid by miles. I cannot break that down here. there's software that does that, right? So credit, income, right? Then assets. So you're going to need money for a down payment. So conventional loans require a 5% minimum down payment. There's some conventional loan programs that allow 3%. FHA will require a minimum of 3.5%. So on a $100,000 home, 3% is $3,000. On a $300,000 home, 3% is $9,000, right? So you're gonna need your down payment. You're gonna need closing costs. You're gonna need money for title services. So there's a title company that's gonna deal with county and state taxes and records and recording fees and all this stuff. There's a cost of doing business with them. Let's just say that, okay? And then depending if you decide to loop or include your taxes and insurance with your mortgage payment, if you're escorting, you're going to have to prepay your first year of hazard insurance and put money into an escrow account for taxes and home insurance. And that, and any lender fees that they may charge you, that is what constitutes your cash to close, right? So, not that I expect you to do that line by line. The loan officer you work with should be able to break that down for you. But this is my way of telling you that you're going to need more money than your down payment. Okay? And then also consider this. Once you get into the home that you're looking for, there may be things that you need to fix. You may want money to buy furniture. You may just want to have additional cash. So the more assets, the better. So for anyone that's trying to get into the home ownership game, you can start by preparing your income, assets, and credit. Getting them in order. All right? If you have to pay down debts to free up your financial flexibility monthly, if you have to, you know, work more, get a better job, which is easier said than done, that's another way you can impact your monthly income. Credit, you just talked about it. Pull your credit report. I'll also tell you, lock your credit file for that user. That way people can't steal your identity. Because there's some people that do terrible shit. But anyway, these are the things that you could do to prepare yourself. If you focus on your credit, income, and assets, you'll be in a space to where, if you're not mortgage ready by year one, hopefully by year three, by year four, by year five, you'll get there. And I've seen people do it. And I know we went from talking about how home ownership and poverty are affected, correlate to a crash course in mortgage preparation, but they're connected. So this is for any of those of you that want to buy a home one day and don't know how to get it done, or you're going to go get with some counselor that's going to charge you a bunch of money to maybe not really help you. The knowledge is free. And I'm not saying that there aren't counselors out there that are doing very good work. I'm talking about the snake oil, so, right? But this information is public. You can verify yourself, empower yourself with it. This is how you prepare for a successful home buying experience. The more cash you have down gives you more leverage. The stronger your credit is gives you a better rate. And the more information you're equipped with will give you an understanding of not only what you're hearing from your lender, but what you can afford. That's real. That's real. And I hope you understand how important home ownership is to a family's generational wealth. It's important to the development of the children. It's important to breaking systematic cycles. It can be as simple as taking a kid from an inner city away from certain things to a more rural area or just a better area to where they can play outside or be safer, a little bit healthier childhood. For real. That stability will do a lot for a kid. And to be honest with you, my sort of perspective is that we doing this to prevent a generation of that, right? Let's be real. Some of the things that I experienced, although they made me strong, and if you've been through something as well, it probably made you strong. We also know that there's a price to strength and not everyone needs to go through everything. I wouldn't want my children to go through some of the things that I went through, although it gave me strength. That's just being real. Now, we could do a whole episode on rich people talking about how spoiled the kids are and how terrible they turn out. That's another thing, right? Getting children that have faced no adversity. Be real with you, man. Grit, that perseverance, is a lot about people's character. We're going to do an episode on that, man. Perseverance. But, yeah, man, that's what I'm feeling. That's what's on my heart, man. So for those of you that are currently homeowners, congratulations. Continue to build your assets and acquire assets and acquire cash and build your leverage to where you can go purchase more homes or more assets that are going to appreciate. And for those of you that are still aspiring, I'm telling you that it can be done. It will be done. The information for you to empower yourself is all readily available. You just have to search for it. And if your credit and your income and your assets are together, you're going to have lenders looking to lend you money, and no one can deny it because they can't redline it. See how deep that was? That shit is real, man. That's terrible. Growing up, they used to call kids ghetto booty scratchers. I don't know any of these babies remember that, right? Ghetto booty scratcher. Where does that shit come from? The term ghetto, it was used as a slur. Now we come to find out that we were systematically forced and kept in some of these areas and then slurred for it. It's bugged out, yo. Actually, it's bugged out. We spitting real facts, man. We didn't even get to the rap shit yet, man. I'm just letting you know what will be going on through my consciousness. And hopefully you relate. But we will get to the rap shit, for real. But this is more important, man. If one person watches this video and they implement something that helps them get to the next tier, we did it. Praise God. For real. How do you think I should talk about this more, man? I was thinking about doing like a webinar PowerPoint, but that seems boring. Like, I gotta talk to people. I gotta interact. I gotta tell jokes that even I know are really funny that people may not laugh at. I gotta do that. You know what I'm saying? In order for me to get into my groove. Now, I dropped a lot of facts today about the correlation of home ownership and poverty. And I'm not saying that because you live in a house, you're not poor. And I'm not saying you can't be rich in an apartment. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's such a systematic and statistical nuances to owning a home and renting. And I believe the way that we can put our children in the best position and ultimately provide them with a safe, clean, and nurturing space. And that often mostly comes when you're able to purchase your own home. So, I want you, if you listen to this, you're trying to get over the hump, it don't matter how long it takes you. That's another thing. Don't let nobody make you feel a certain way because they maybe hit a tier or first, they hit a level first before you got there. That has nothing to do with anything. God has what He has in store for you, regardless of what happens with anyone else. That's all you need to focus on. So if you're getting there late, so what? Just get there. If it takes you to your 50 to get it done, purchase your first home, or hit any target you have for yourself, just get it done. You know? I wasn't very fast. I didn't run track. But from what I understand about relays or any race, is that runners don't look at other runners, they just look at where they're running. Shout out to Minds Out Productions for the beat too, man. Hope you're doing good, brother. Universal frequency. I'm excited about where this podcast is and where it's going to go, what we're going to do with it, and how we're going to help people, and how we're going to give away game and information that is valuable. That is valuable. You know? And we're talking to the people, the everyday people. We're not talking to the people that donate. We're talking to the people that do it. Still, 1 in 6 children in the state of Connecticut are food insecure and don't know where their next meal is coming from. This is why the FNX Foundation raises awareness for food insecurity and financial literacy. We just read numbers that said people coming from red light areas are 3 times more likely to not be insured. That's a major issue. And I talked about it in my last episode. When people die in those communities, it's a financial burden to everyone that's around if life insurance is not in place. Because we financially have to come out of pocket to do these things, as opposed to an insurance policy being paid out and it actually creating wealth moving forward. Let me think about how that activity, that one step of, you know, the human experience, right? Life insurance and leaving something to your children when you die, as opposed to leaving them with pills. That has an impact on generational wealth. How wealth is systematically passed down. It 1,000,000% does. And it perpetuates a cycle. Y'all don't hear it, but this is way too connected for it to be accidental. Right? So I kind of feel like, however this was designed by some really smart people, right? Economics and the system to keep certain people marginalized, all that. None of this is by accident. But it's nothing that can't be overcome. To be real. All it takes is a little game. It's a little bit. FNXmusic.com is coming. We're launching the website. Rise of the Phoenix Project is coming. We're shooting a bunch of videos. We're going to get into the rapidy rap shit. So don't think I have forgotten. I have not. But God is just calling me to do this. This is really important. And we're going to continue to grow the platform to help people. That's what we're here for. That's what we're here for, man. This stuff is deep. I've actually thought about going to get a doctorate in something like this. I have 2 ideas for a doctorate before I slide on it, right? My first one is an idea that's been proven before, but it's gonna tie financial literacy specifically and community involvement to profitability. Why businesses, not just banks, but any corporation, should want to cultivate the community around them. So basically like, hey, I live in the soil, let me take care of it so we grow fruit that I would like to eat. You know, to document and show proof that activities of reinvestment of education and resources in the community around us is not only good for the people that you are affecting, but good for business. I've thought about that. And I know some people have done similar topics, but I have a way that I'm going to go about it. It's Dr. Phillips. Second thing, I don't know what to say. We're going to hold off on that yet because I don't want nobody stealing my idea. Real shit, man. Real shit. But yeah, man. Let me know what you think of that, man. Tying financial literacy and corporate social responsibility and philanthropy and the community. Tying all that to actual business record. I think that'd be live, man. Dr. Phoenix, I think I could do it. Dr. Phoenix, man. That could be a rap name. But yeah, man, this is the Universal Frequency Podcast. This is episode 3. We brought some real topics down. We having educated discussions. We are busting down the universe. So after you tune in, you leave being a better version of yourself. That's the Universal Frequency. For real. Shout out to Donkey Bonks TV. So we powered by. Happy Father's Day. Happy Juneteenth. I'm glad the bum ass Celtics lost. You're a Celtics fan, so what? I'm a Laker fan. It is what it is. But I want y'all to have a nice night, man. So we're gonna run it back. Let me know what you think about, like, should I build a library of resources? Directing people towards articles and programs and anything that may help them bring to life the dream of owning a home or just better preparing them. Man, let me know. That's what we're doing. Vibration, energy frequency vibration.